puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
Time now for Abandoned Manitoba, where we check in with Gordon Goldsboro from the Manitoba Historical Society. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, Keisha.
Now tell me, what are we discussing this week?
Well, we're going to unveil a mystery. You know, there's a number of prominent abandoned buildings around Manitoba whose history, well, frankly, I've not been able to uncover. One of them is a three-story concrete skeleton that has stood at the corner of Plingit and Archibald Streets here in Winnipeg for decades.
And you had said last week that you had just learned about the history of this building, correct?
Right. Thanks to Jordan Makachuk. He's a volunteer researcher for the Manitoba Historical Society. I finally found out the story behind the building. It's intrigued me for years. Every time that I drove past it, I wondered what the building had been. Now, to my discredit, I didn't consider all the clues that were evident at the site. In addition to the skeleton, there is a long, low building immediately beside it. There's a squat little grain elevator beside that building. Now that I know the history of the site, it all makes sense.
Now, you describe the building as a skeleton. What do you mean by this?
Anyone who has seen a modern multi-story building under construction knows that it typically consists of a steel or reinforced concrete frame on which the floors, the roof, the exterior walls, all of them are attached to this frame. This construction method made possible the skyscrapers that began to dot Winnipeg's skyline in the early 20th century. But the building we're considering today is no skyscraper, and its normally concealed skeleton is readily visible. The stout concrete construction of the building, combined with the fact that the floors between the levels are perforated in numerous places by various size holes, suggested to me that the building had some kind of industrial use. Now, my research indicated that in the mid-20th century, the site had hosted a grain elevator. So, in error, I jumped to the conclusion that the skeleton had been a mill where grain was crushed to make flour. Turns out, I was partially right. Grain was involved, but not in the production of flour.
What was the building?
Well, to set the stage for the site's history, we need to revisit an episode of Abandoned Manitoba back in August of 2020. At that time, we discussed a large building on St. Joseph Street in Old St. Boniface. That building was constructed in late 1924 as the first brewery in the city after the repeal of Prohibition. At the time, I didn't make much of its location in what is still today a predominantly Francophone part of Manitoba. I should have remembered that Manitobans held no fewer than four referendums on the question of prohibiting the sale of alcoholic beverages in 1892, 1902, 1916, and 1918. And in all but the last of those referendums, St. Boniface residents voted conspicuously against the provincial trend by voting against Prohibition. In other words, they supported the sale of alcohol in St. Boniface. So if there was any place in Manitoba that would be in favor of more access to alcohol and favor of making alcohol, well, it would be St. Boniface. You know, they hosted the first post-production brewery, and as it turns out, also the first post-prohibition distillery.
So the concrete skeleton was a distillery?
Yes. Yes, that's it. So in January 1925, several noted Winnipeg businessmen, with financial support from American interests, incorporated something called the Manitoba Refinery Company, and its business objective was to brew and distill. Now, whiskey and other strong spirits are made by brewing malted barley, that's the first step, into what is essentially beer, then concentrating the alcohol in that beer through a distillation process so you can get up into the high alcohol levels that we typically expect of spirits. The spirits acquire flavor and complexity when they mature over several years inside special wooden barrels. In late March of 1925, the construction firm of Carter Halls Aldinger began building a complex designed by architect George Northwood next to the CPR tracks on Archibald Street. And it was expected that the distillery there then would begin operations by June of 1925.
Now, Gordon, you just described the distillery as a complex. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you meant by that?
Well, a distillery in this case consisted of three buildings, not just the concrete skeleton that housed the actual brewing and distilling equipment. Malted barley needed to start the brewing process would be stored in that grain elevator, the little squat one that I mentioned before, that is still standing there today. Once the spirits were distilled and they had the final alcohol, they would then be transferred into wooden barrels and set on their sides in a maturation warehouse. That's the long, low building that still stands beside the skeleton. The fact that there was a warehouse to mature the alcohol tells us this was not a factory to make alcohol for industrial purposes. Yes, they sometimes make alcohol for various, processes in the industry that don't involve consumption. But if you're using maturation, well, then it has to be alcohol that's intended for people to drink.
What sorts of alcoholic beverages did the distillery make?
As near as I could tell, it made three products. The first was a Scotch type of whiskey marketed under the name of Black Watch. A second was a bourbon type of whiskey called Clearbrook. And the third, a gin named Blackfriars. We have no way of knowing what they were like, but a company official back in the 20s was quoted in a local newspaper as saying that he thought its products were equal, if not better, than those of Scotland. And those are fighting words in some quarters. When at full production in mid-1926, the St. Boniface Distillery employed 70 people. And get this, it produced 1,500 gallons of alcohol each and every day.
Wow. That's a lot. I'm wondering now what happened to the distillery to cause it to become a skeletal building?
Well, unfortunately, it did not thrive. In late 1927, the distillery was sold to a Montreal-based company called National Distilleries. It was a bigger company. Then in mid-1931, just less than 4 years later, it was sold again, this time to another Montreal company called Midwest Distillers. And finally, in late December of 1933, barely 2 years later, the business was sold yet again, this time to a company from Boston, Massachusetts. The American company was interested not in running the operation, not in actually making alcohol there. They were interested only in the state-of-the-art equipment that was inside the distillery building. They didn't want the buildings. They didn't want the land. And I theorize what they did was they simply removed the exterior walls of the building to make it easier to remove the equipment and then to pack everything in railway cars, ship it to Massachusetts, and then reassemble it in Boston. In other words, they were just scavenging the company for its parts. The building, the land, they didn't want. Well, they sold it to something called the McCabe Grain Company. And that company continued to use the little grain elevator of the former distillery, along with another one that they built. But the idea was to hold grain to be blended and ground into animal feed. And this feed they stored and sold from the former whiskey maturation warehouse. So they did continue to use the buildings, at least the other two buildings, but there seems to have been no purpose for the old gutted distillery building. And my guess is that it was simply left exactly as that Boston company had left it, and which it remains that way today. So to sum up its history, that concrete skeleton that so perplexed me for so long had 8 years of life as a distillery and 89 years as an abandoned building.
Wow, that's quite a contrast there. Can you give us a hint, Gordon, about next week's episode?
Well, 2 weeks ago, I had an opportunity to jump back 100 years when steam was the predominant source of power on Manitoba farms. Next week, I will discuss my time travel experiences on a century farm near Langruth.
Looking forward to it.
Talk next week. Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.